This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and subscribe to it there, along with Reason's other great programs, the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum Debates. Today, I am joined by Katie Herzog, late of the Seattle Stranger, and Jesse Single, late of, I guess, New York Magazine and a bunch of other things. Part of the reason I'm talking to them is that they're late of a lot of stuff. They have a great new podcast called Blocked and Reported. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about media self-censorship. We're also going to talk about models for new media. These guys are raking in, on an annualized basis, $96,000 a year on Patreon. So we're going to talk about all of that and less, I'm sure. Katie and Jesse, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, man. Thank you very much.
Okay. And just to be clear, that was Jesse, the second voice. Katie is the first voice.
This is me, Katie Herzog.
Okay. Yeah. Very good.
I'm the baritone.
You're based in Brooklyn and Seattle. You are a mismatch pair. You're on opposite ends of the coast. What is Blocked and Reported about? Katie, why don't you start? Because Jesse is, he just doesn't seem to get his shit together.
It's a progressive stack. She's a member of an oppressed group.
Yeah. Also why Jesse has decided to give me 80% of our Patreon earnings. He's combating the gender wage crisis. The easiest way to explain it, I think, is to say that it's about dumb internet bullshit. And that really encompasses quite a bit. So it ends up mostly being about the media, what happens in social media, but also what happens in sort of the broader media climate. Jesse and I think, are both interested primarily in human psychology and why people do kind of the insane things that people do. So there's a lot of sort of overlap with human behavior. But it's really just about sort of the moment we're in now. And luckily for us, the moment we're in now has plenty of material.
Yeah, Jesse, what would you add to that?
I think Katie summed it up well. I think the podcast ended up being way more topical than we could have possibly hoped. It was like we launched a iceberg awareness podcast a week before the Titanic launched. No, I think where there's a sense in which a lot of people on the left in particular don't feel like they can have the basic conversations that constitute healthy civic discourse. And there's been this attempt that Katie and I have both experienced to suggest that even among people who have broad agreement on basic principles, you know, if you disagree on these rather subtle, nuanced, and ever-changing rules about what you're supposed to believe and say, you know, you can sort of be cast out in a sense, or painted as a reactionary or evil or far right. And it gets exhausting. And I think a lot of people have reached a breaking point. And that's why people are willing to listen to our dumb voices talk about internet bullshit.
How would you describe yourselves? I think you've both written for Reason. And a close second to that is that I'm pretty sure somebody from Reason has bought each of you a drink at a happy hour. But Katie, how do you define yourself politically?
Well, I guess since we've both written for Reason and we've both been the beneficiaries of Reason staffers' largesse, I think that means we're Coke-funded shills. Is that correct?
That sounds about right. And yeah. By the way, I just want to point out that term is trademarked. And every time you say it, somebody gets richer and richer.
I hope it's you. I consider myself a liberal, although I have, in the last few years, I have moved away from any sort of identification with political labels. I've also become much more skeptical of movements entirely. So maybe 5 years ago, I would have called myself a feminist or an environmentalist or these sort of labels that represent something, not necessarily represent like actual activism, but sort of just taglines to sort of signal who you are. And I don't anymore. So in an ideal world, I would call myself independent or maybe centrist.
Right.
But I think that it's important for me, at least, to sort of stick with the liberal label because, for one, it does reflect how I vote, but also because I feel like there's been the liberal position has taken a lot of hits recently. And I want to sort of stick my stake down and say, like, no, someone who believes in these sort of classical liberal values, enlightenment values of, things like free inquiry and free speech and due process, these things that we used to think of as liberal values, the value of inquiry and science, I want those to remain liberal values. And so while other liberals and leftists may have, I suppose, shaken off those values, I maintain that they're still liberal values. But I think ideally, like, the fewer labels, the better.
Yeah. How old are you, if you don't mind my asking?
I'm 37.
Okay. And did you grow up in the Pacific Northwest?
No, I grew up in North Carolina in sort of a rural Appalachian area in North Carolina.
Okay. Jesse, what about you? How do you define yourself?
I think by like any reasonable standard, I'm I guess I'm a liberal, but pretty far to the left, if you want to carve up the spectrum into sort of left, then liberals, then centrists. You know, on a lot of sort of the classic redistributive questions, I have very reason unfriendly beliefs. But part of what's interesting about the schism going on is like there are a lot of these sort of cultural questions or internet blowups where, you know, I was glad to write for Reason, but I just pulled up my author page to remind myself what I'd written for you guys. And, you know, it was a wonderful experience. Thank you to the Koch brothers in particular. But these are pieces that under normal circumstances, you could have written for like a, you know, a circa 2005 Slate or the New Republic, but it feels
right.
Less and less room to do that.
What did you write for us?
I guess like, so one of them, I made fun of this tendency to say, there was a piece in the outline about how you shouldn't use the term space colonization because that's colonization, which is bad and murdered a lot of people. And
that's true. Yeah.
Exactly the sort of bullshit that makes the left look like clowns, and that we should, we should say that's silly. Everyone understands that's not how language works. Words can mean multiple things. So that's like the kind of fun piece that I think would have a left of center publication would have happily run until fairly recently. And there's still some holdovers like Conor Friedersdorf, folks in that vein. But
right.
More and more, it's like the, as the culture wars get more intense, you need to show you're on the right side. And for stuff that stupid, I don't want to.
Man, and if you think it's hard to tear down statues with Earth's gravity, you know, wait until you're on a planet with almost no gravity. Right?
Exactly.
And no people.
Jesse, where are you from? You're a Massel. Right?
I'm a Massel and an asshole. I'm from outside Boston. Yeah. Go Patriots. I know people want to hear that. So I grew up in the suburbs outside Boston.
And how old are you?
36.
Okay. Wow. You guys. So are you guys you're millennials, right?
Yeah. We're old.
We're the oldest millennials. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And so, and you're like Quizlets because you're in favor of, free speech and open inquiry, right? And you're pushing back against the most ridiculous successes of identitarian politics.
It's working really well, as you can tell from the movement of the culture. We're having a huge impact.
Yeah, it looks like, I mean, people can't see this, but Katie seems to be in a closet covered in blankets, and Jesse can't even afford a video camera. We're on Zoom, but, he's hidden.
But I think this gets to an important distinction. Can I just,
Sure.
It would be one thing if people our age had turned en masse against free speech. I think it's much more the case that a pretty small minority that is overrepresented in media has sort of created this weird system where you can get shouted down for believing stuff that most people believe in. So it's sort of maybe a spiral of silence kind of thing or something. I don't actually think there's a massive generational shift on these core questions. Right. It's just like, who gets to speak up?
And, I would say on the flip side, I'm at the tail end of the baby boom, and it's not like baby boomers were, en masse were in favor of free speech either. I think most people are probably, pretty free speech oriented and, see some excesses. So it's always worth thinking, about. I'm not sure I believe in generations, certainly not in any kind of clear cut way that we tend to talk about them, but they're always a mixed bag. Each of you has had at least one or more kind of intense fundamental experiences with cancel culture that obviously informs your podcast, both the title as well as your careers and things like that. Can you, let's start with Katie again. What is your origin story? What's the equivalent of the radioactive spider that bit you and kind of politicized you into your current state of being?
So my radioactive spider was a piece I wrote in 2017 for The Stranger, which was Seattle's alt-weekly or alt-biweekly now. And it was called The Detransitioners, they were transgender and then they weren't, or something like that. I totally remember the subtitle. And so I wrote that piece as a freelancer, and there was a
this was a piece about people who had transitioned, either, I guess, not fully surgically, but in various ways.
From
male to female, or et cetera. And then they were like, I want to go back.
Right. And I interviewed maybe 7 or 8 people for the piece, or 7 or 8 detransitioners for the piece. And some were sort of at the beginning of the transition and then maybe started taking hormones and they didn't have sort of lasting physical effects. And others, there were 2 males I spoke to who had full gender reassignment surgery. So now they are re-identified men with vaginas, or with neo-vaginas, right. You know, and so that was really the piece that did it for me. Before that, I had written primarily about environmentalism and climate change. I'd been a staff writer at the digital magazine in Seattle called Grist. And before that, I'd worked in public radio. So a pretty traditional liberal career path.
What was the, your kind of infamy preceded you, I think I've only met you once briefly, but I remember, you know, I'd heard about this story that had put you on the shit list of everyone, and I went and read it, and I have to say, I say this as somebody who Reason, I'm maybe unduly proud that Reason has had a trans contributing editor for 40 years or something like that, and you know, it's to me that it's so part of the idea of trans everything is so central, but it's totally part of a libertarian ethos of, you know, of individualism, of become who you want to be. And when I read your story, I was amazed because it's a beautifully written and beautifully reported piece that is so profoundly human, and people were screaming bloody murder about it. What was the nature of their, you know, upset with you?
Well, I think a lot of people didn't read it was the thing. You know, it was this, at the very beginning, there were a couple of prominent voices, particularly people in Seattle, some prominent trans activists, and then people outside of Seattle, who really took issue with the piece. And they had sort of, I think some had some valid complaints maybe, but a lot of it was just sort of, you can't write this because you're not trans. And so it was just this total identity-based critique of the piece.
Right. And then, of course, if you were trans, you wouldn't have wanted to write it or something. Right. So ultimately, it is kind of about silencing.
Right. I mean, and plus by that, you know, by that metric, really only a detransitioner could have written the piece. And yet when detransitioners sort of write their own stories, there's still the same sort of outcry. So the identity politics only gets you so far. And so there was it was just a total shitstorm. I mean, people were literally burning stacks of the paper and sending me video of it. There were stickers all over Seattle calling me a TERF and a neo-Nazi and a transphobe, stickers that are still there. And my reputation in Seattle just really never recovered from that. And I didn't help by, you know, when Me Too emerged, I was critical of some of the excesses of Me Too. I'm deeply concerned about things like due process and free speech and these, what I see as some authoritarian trends on the left. And I wrote about it. And Seattle is a very homogenous city ideologically and racially. And so I just became sort of marked as the enemy. And I think oftentimes, like I always thought, like, I should write a piece, just any piece that I would write under my own byline, and just give myself a pseudonym and see what the reaction is. So I think part of it was just I became sort of the bad one. And then anything that I did, well, if Herzog wrote it, then it's evil. You know, and when people, the funny thing is that when people do read the detransition piece, what they typically find is that it's sort of a compassionate, nuanced report on groups of people. I included the voices of happily transitioned people. It had trans sensitivity readers. I don't think anybody's sort of coming into this fight without these, you know, bias and sort of their blinders on would find the piece hate speech. But a lot of people did, if they read it.
What is it like to have, you know, death threats, or, and if not actual death threats, you know, just thousands of people hating you like that? I mean, what does that feel like?
It doesn't feel good. And I want to say I haven't had maybe any death threats. And I say that because I think that the assumption that all women who I've had threats, but they're things like I'm going to spit on you or whatever. And I say that because I think it's important that I think that people sort of assume that women get more death and rape threats than I personally have experienced. I think that narrative is a little bit exaggerated. So while I have had thousands of people scream at me and approach me in public, and I've had some very uncomfortable encounters, I've never had death threats. And I don't think that's because my haters are like better people than anybody else's haters. I mean, I do get...
Thankfully, death threats are rare.
Katie, did you not get my death threats? I've been sending a huge number of them.
I only get death threats from Jesse.
I'm getting them. I think you're misdirecting them, Jesse.
My fault.
Katie, why did you become a journalist? Why did you become a writer?
I sort of fell into it. I wanted to be a writer. I studied creative writing in college, but I sort of fell into journalism. I don't have a traditional career path. I've never taken courses in journalism, but I wanted to write. And this was a way to write and have an audience and get paid for it, until, of course, it wasn't because the economy is collapsing and there's a pandemic.
And we're going to get to that in a second, the new forms of media, because you guys are rolling around in cash right now. If nothing else, I want you to be mugged after this podcast because you guys seem to be so filthy rich. Jesse, what is your origin story? What is the most that you've been either canceled or attacked and things like that?
Yeah. So back in, 2015, 2014, I wrote about Gamergate a fair amount and was skeptical of Gamergate, which was this sort of complicated culture war that your listeners definitely don't want me to get into. But the long and the short
of it. We reported a fair amount on that. And it's, the minute you said 2015 or 2014, I was like, what, was Harding president or something? It seems unfathomably long ago.
Yeah.
Last week seems, that seems 1,000 years ago. And then when you bring up Gamergate, what can you just very quickly, in like 3 words or less, what was the essential thing about Gamergate?
3 words or less. Kill me now. No. Yeah. So it was basically a group of ardent video gamers who spent too much time online got involved in what was initially a breakup, where the male wrote a long blog post about his girlfriend being evil. The girlfriend was involved in game development. This led to a whole blow up where a bunch of people said they were just trying to get games journalism to be more ethical, in my view. Right. They more had a cultural complaint because they didn't like that games were getting more progressive. And it became this really ugly incident. It also, in the minds of some progressives, is like sort of got overblown. People were like, oh, Gamergate like brought us Trump, or that it initiated new forms of online harassment that have always been around. So,
and although it did seem to crystallize certain of them, and I guess it was Milo Yiannopoulos, to name somebody who, is he an ancient Roman or is he a guy from a couple of years ago who can't get work now? But he emerged. He ultimately was kind of the marquee celebrity.
It attracted a lot of very opportunistic demagogues who just made some money off this, but all of which is go ahead.
Okay, so you and Gamergate, what happened?
Yeah, no, that got a subset of the right mad at me, and then there were other instances in which right wingers sort of piled onto me on Twitter. Like I criticized Breitbart for, they picked some random nobody who made a tasteless joke about a dead cop, and Breitbart blew her up, and it got her driven from her house by death threats. So I told her story. So therefore, that meant I was on her side, on the anti-cop side, and Breitbart went after me. Most of my experiences until 2017 or so had been the right hating me. And then I wrote an article.
And if we're being honest, your friends and family.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I have lots. Since I was born, I have experienced being hated by everybody. I meant online hatred.
That's why you divide the world into Boston and outside Boston.
Exactly. So anyway, I first really caught controversy from the left, also writing about trans issues. My first piece that got me in trouble was an investigative look at a clinic in Toronto that got shut down by a doctor who was accused of conversion therapy, or trying to turn trans kids cisgender, meaning trying to sort of force them out of being trans. And I looked into it, and the charges against him were 95% bullshit. And I showed that the single biggest charge was just a misunderstanding on the part of his accuser that was retracted when the accuser realized. And despite the fact that my story was journalistically bulletproof, I was seen by other journalists as having defended someone who was indefensible. Like the facts of the matter didn't matter.
And he was indefensible because he was wrongly accused of practicing conversion therapy.
Yes, he was a loathed figure in the Toronto transgender community. And, it may well be the case that his clinic took too conservative approach or something like that. But I looked for evidence of that he'd done what he was accused of, and I found none, and people weren't happy about that. And a little bit later in 2018, I wrote a story for The Atlantic about basically what the process should look like for diagnosing kids with gender dysphoria and putting them on hormones, and in some cases, giving them surgery for like 16-year-olds. And similar to Katie's, it was we went out of our way to show that there's scientific evidence that kids with dysphoria benefit from transitioning. The questions in the piece were all about complicated situations, like what the assessment process should look like. I'm going to sneeze. We can edit this out, please. So the whole story was about sort of these complicated questions that everyone within transgender medicine agrees are complicated. Like, at what point are you comfortable putting a 13-year-old on hormones that will have a permanent effect? This is not something you're really allowed to talk about on the mainstream left, because there's this very oversimplified narrative that kids know who they are, full stop. So people Right. treat 13-year-olds as almost adults in a way they wouldn't in any other context. So that story was really when I think there was a tipping point and I really began being seen in some corners as a loathed figure. And I wish I could sort of present myself as having been expelled from society, but I can't, because I still get work and I'm doing well in journalism at a time when I'm lucky to do so. But there's a subset of people on the left who really despise me and have sort of tried to ruin my career, as they have with Katie.
What each of you, I mean, you know, the issue of trans rights and whatnot is kind of fascinating. And there was that moment when Caitlyn Jenner emerged. I wrote a piece for the Daily Beast. I was a columnist back then about how, and I grew up with Bruce Jenner as the apotheosis of Cold War, you know, American freedom-loving masculinity. And it was kind of brilliant to see Bruce Jenner, who beat the fucking communists in the 1976 Olympics in this triumphant world record-setting performance, you know, become Caitlyn Jenner. What is the fascination that we have with trans people, and why do we talk so much about it? Because statistically, it is a vanishingly small percentage of the population. I do hazard a guess on that. Katie?
This is something that we've talked about before. I do think there is something inherently interesting about it, you know, and certainly we talk about trans issues way, way, way more today than we did 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever. But still, when you had, you know, the first sex reassignment surgeries, and I believe the 1950s in Europe, this was a story of, this was an international story. You know, in the 80s and 90s, Jerry Springer would have the sort of quote unquote shemale, you know, reveals on the show. So I do think there's...
Every sitcom had, you know, whether it was Archie Bunker, George Jefferson, their old war buddy, you know, who they hadn't seen in 30 years, comes around and they've transitioned.
I think there is something inherently interesting about this, because this idea that you can change something that's so fundamental about human biology, it's just interesting. And maybe it shouldn't be, but it is. And why we have a fascination with it now, well, Jesse and I have talked about this too. And I think part of the reason that this has emerged in culture to be sort of the cultural force isn't just, you know, the emergence of people like Caitlyn Jenner or Janet Mock or these trans celebrities, but also, and this is speculation on my part, but I'm going to speculate away. So after the passage of gay, or after, not the passage, after the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage in 2015, you had all of these gay rights organizations that had been intensely focused on that one issue for years or decades. And all of a sudden, that fight has been won. And it's not as though everything magically, you know, like all anti-gay policies changed overnight. I mean, just today, the Supreme Court ruled on on a job non-discrimination issue, ruled in favor of the LGBTQ plaintiffs, I suppose they are in this case. And so I think that after gay marriage passed, these organizations had to pivot. They had to pivot because they'd won this fight. And so they pivoted from gay issues to trans issues. So now you had this ecosystem of activists who didn't want to lose their jobs in some cases, or didn't want to lose their identity. So they just pivoted. They just said, all right, we did trans stuff, or we did gay stuff. Now we're going to do trans stuff. And I think that's part of the reason this has emerged as a much larger battle.
So that's kind of like the story that gets told about the March of Dimes, which was established to combat polio, raise money for polio research. And then when polio was defeated, they were like, okay, well, we're going to keep going.
Right, right. Like how many organizations after whatever cause they're working for, after they've won, how many organizations say, you know what, we did it. Let's just fold up. We did it. Let's just put ourselves out of a job. Most don't, which I think is totally natural. I mean, not just, you know, the need to work, but also your identity wrapped up in this and being an activist or whatever. So that's sort of my suspicion is part of it is this shift over from these advocacy groups from gay to trans.
Jesse, what's your sense of things?
I think Katie's like much better on the sort of recent history of LGBT groups. I guess the only thing I'd add is there's a slight on the outskirts of this issue. There's a little bit of a moral panic going on with kids, where we periodically have moral panics involving kids, right? Stranger danger, satanic sex abuse. I don't think what's going on is on the level of that, but like I get leaked stuff from closed Facebook groups where parents believe their kids are trans, and there's this real panic that like if you don't immediately accept your 3-year-old's utterance that they're trans, I saw someone whose 3 or 4-year-old had just quote unquote come out ask sort of this closed group what to do. Should they do a full social transition, meaning new name, new pronoun, new clothes? And the first response said that basically the kid would kill themselves if there wasn't an immediate social transition. This is a 3 or 4-year-old. God knows the details. God knows what this kid meant when they said whatever they said. But it's this very weird idea that parents could be grievously harming their kids unless they sort of listen to kids in a way you maybe wouldn't in other situations. And I just want to be clear that there's a subset of kids who are deeply gender dysphoric from a young age, and they should be listened to. And this is a well-known phenomenon. But that's taking a kid to a gender clinic and helping them work through these issues and decide if transition is best is a little bit different from a mom or dad freaking out because a 4-year-old just said out of nowhere, I'm a boy, and imagining that they're going to do that kid immediate, imminent harm if they don't immediately transition them.
How would a 4-year-old kill itself, himself, herself, their self?
Dude, it's so crazy. It's also just like, as we've discussed, it's disturbing to spread the idea that kids are killing themselves left and right. And yeah, it's...
Well, there's never a shortage. When you said there's often moral panics involving children, I think of it more, it's the reverse, where every couple of, once in a while, we have a week or two where there isn't a moral panic about kids. But I mean, I read about this in Reason, 20 plus years ago now, but kids increasingly, because we have fewer of them and we invest them more, both literally and figuratively with meaning and with dollars and all of that, they're almost blank screens upon which we can project our endless and, deep, deep anxieties and worries and concerns and things like that.
That's what I'm going to do if I have kids. I'm just going to instead of having a therapist.
No, you think you won't. I say this as the father of two. And you're always like, I'm not going to be that person. I'm going to let my kids, they're going to get on. You're always fighting. You're not just fighting the last war. You're fighting like the last 10 wars and one future one that you think you remember from an episode of the Twilight Zone or something. It's a endlessly fascinating exercise in humility, ambivalence, and disaster being a parent.
Jesse, I think it would only be fair for you to have children for them to all come out as trans.
Yeah, but would it be fair for them to have him as a parent?
No, yes, it will give them something to rebel against. Yeah.
Nick, I think it was on the nose for you to name both your kids Nick. That struck me as a little weird.
Well, that way I have a spare. And if you look closely, one of them, there's a little mark, a prime mark. So, we can tell them apart. But, well, let's talk about the current, of Blocked and Reported, kind of the broad context of your podcast. There has been over the past couple of weeks, and, it's been almost 30 minutes since we started talking. So, the body count could be much, much higher, but there has just been a profusion of people getting fired from almost legacy media outfits, people at the New York Times, people at Condé Nast Publications. Refinery 29, it doesn't count as legacy media, but there was a bloodletting there. What do you guys make of this? Because I want to get to a conversation where we talk about what you're doing as a new form of media and using things like Patreon, which has been around for a while, but allows you to kind of both distribute as well as fund your new forms of journalism that 20 years ago would have been nearly impossible to pull off. But, it seems as if more and more journalists are locked in a saw room from the movie. And, you know, everybody's chained to the same radiator and the only way out is to hack off other people's lips.
Yeah, I think you said it earlier when you said moral panic. That's what I think is going on. I think what we're seeing, someone in my DMs referred to what's happening right now is Me Too for microaggressions. So I guess that makes it Me Too too. But I think that's what's happening. I think that
or Me Too'd, maybe.
So I think, you know, this is a continuation of what we've seen emerging over the past couple of years. I guess you could call it cancel culture. And it is interesting that these panics or these purges do seem to be isolated in sort of highbrow media, tech, commerce, you know, white collar industries where this is also speculation but I'm guessing that these industries are actually far more sensitive to things like diversity and equity and inclusion than sort of working class industries. And so I think it's interesting that we saw the same thing during Me Too, where you had the biggest cases were in places like Hollywood and media. And you didn't hear about, you know, the woman who works at the Waffle House down the street whose ass is grabbed every day. And I don't know that woman's life has changed at all since Me Too. And I think that what we're seeing now is just sort of a continuation of that, you know, spurned on by first the pandemic and then the killing of George Floyd. It's been just wild to watch. I'm more and more convinced that we're in the midst of a mass hysteria that probably started around the time Donald Trump was elected, and has ramped up over the past 4 years.
I have to tell you, in my lifetime, my favorite moral panic really is the
Satanic
80s
panic.
Moral panic over Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Tipper Gore's How to Raise PG Kids in an X-Rated World is so fucking awesome. And I like to, I dip into it. I have a paperback copy of it, and I dip into it. It's like, you know, reading a novel by a Kurt Vonnegut character or something. It's so insane, and every page gets more and more insane. I'm just mad she didn't cover killer bees in that. Jesse, what's your sense? Why do you think people are, there's just so many firing squads in media? And ultimately, is that, you know, is it, how bad a thing is it? Or is it just, well, this, you know, it happens every couple of years?
I think there's like a few different forces colliding. One of them is that, as Katie and I have noticed, this has been going on for a while. Like journalism, left of center journalism, the Overton window has been closing. So if you want to make an argument that is, for example, fundamentally pro-trans rights and even in favor of kids transitioning, but you don't go the full nine yards and say, you know, 12-year-olds know exactly who they are, there shouldn't be much adult supervision, that's enough to get you tagged as problematic. And in that area and certain other areas, you've seen journalism outlets just refuse to cover controversies the way they would if they treated them journalistically. So you already had that dynamic, which I think is driven by polarization and the financial collapse of journalism. I think as there's less and less resources, people invest less in reporting. If you're sort of the thoughtful contrarian thinker, you have less room to maneuver. Then George Floyd is murdered, and you have on top of that this massive and pretty popular and, in my view, righteous protest movement. But I think this thing happens similar to Me Too, where there are fundamental problems there that were long festering. But then on the periphery of the controversy, which is where journalism is, because that's the protests aren't about journalism, they're about police murder and police conduct. There's I don't want to call them opportunists, but there's certainly some people who use a moment of crisis to try to gain power within their institution. So I think what we're seeing is a mix of stories where there really are some insensitive editors. As Katie and I said on Blocked and Reported, like, it would probably suck to be one of the three people of color in a white newsroom, especially a white newsroom that is sort of priding itself on its wokeness. I don't think that'd be fun. But a lot of the stories circulating are a little bit light on details. There was one of the times where a woman complained that her boss gave her a copy of The Strunken White Elements of Style.
Yeah.
She took that as a microaggression, saying she didn't know how to write. For older journalists, I think I missed this a little. I'm a little young for this. That is the book you have on your desk to help you be a better, more thoughtful writer. To interpret someone.
And I am of the, I dislike that book intensely. And like Katie, I have no, and I obviously, unlike you, it shows in me, I have no journalism training at all, but I dislike the elements of style. But yeah, that would be like, God, I've never actually belonged to a you know, an organization that has any sense of tradition, but it would be like being given a key to the city.
Right. Yeah, or like a cop's gun. A cop's gun. It's literally that's what drove me crazy about the story. It is literally a sign of inclusion. This was an executive assistant who I think people in those positions often want to work up and become writers or journalists. This is literally the boss saying, I value you. I think you have potential. This is a symbol of that. And the person responding by calling it a racist microaggression, the idea that to be a good quote unquote ally, I should turn my brain off and just agree with her, which is basically what the Times did. They included a brief quote from him. The story did not include the context, which non-journalists won't know, that like every old school news writer has a copy of this or another style guide on his desk. Like, so the reporting on this has been awful, but you don't want to be the asshole who stands up and says, I disagree with the black woman who said this was a racial microaggression. That's not a fun position to be in.
Okay, you guys are older millennials, and you know we're talking about millennials and Gen Z at this point. You know what's going on? Like, why are you guys like this? And I say that again. My older son is a millennial, and my younger son is Gen Z. I mean, they're 26 and 18. And you know, when I got to work, I felt lucky to have a job, and I worked in entertainment journalism before I went to grad school and ended up at Reason. And you know, if my boss said, you know what, this is shit, like redo it, or, you know, you got to work on this or something, like I was, you know, I was so deferential. I never would have said like, no, fuck you. And I can remember a couple of years ago before I became an editor at large and I was still managing at Reason, we had an intern and I, you know, I would do this typically, you know, I would take one piece that an intern was doing and kind of go over with them in detail to give a sense of how I did stuff and everything. And we went through this piece and it was like, okay, but it was not good because it was written by like a 19-year-old. And I went through what I thought worked and what I didn't. And then he was like, well, you know, I'm kind of good with it the way it is. And I was just like, okay, great. And then like, I didn't talk to him again, because I was like, okay, this guy's not coachable. And I don't mean this in any kind of like overbearing way, but it's like, I'm not going to waste my time on somebody who has achieved perfection, you know, at such a young age. You know, my time is more valuable than that. But what's going on with you guys that your generation seems to be really, you know, you get your hackles up when somebody, you know, your boss says you got to work a little bit harder.
But this is what I find so weird, is that things feel very bifurcated. Like, I don't know about Katie's circle of friends, but everyone in my social circles, which includes people from their early 40s to late 20s mostly, strikes me as normal. I mean, this is almost like some of the stories. I went to University of Michigan at a time when Sean Hannity and Michael Savage were railing about the Marxist indoctrination there. I never saw that.
Sure.
I know there's a subset of wacky academic departments. There's a subset.
I call it Arthur Miller's University. So, you know, and as somebody who sent a kid to Ohio State, I really have to say tough luck.
That's a microaggression.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like a generational problem. I think most people are pretty normal. My friends are mostly do-gooder liberal types in journalism and activism who have worked very hard and take feedback to heart. So I think it's just when people, it's increasingly the case that if your employee does have some personality problem, they will frame their grievance in terms of them being harmed or oppressed. And that's true of people of every race. There's always something. And Katie and I have encountered a lot of people like that, where it's not just disagreement, they're being harmed, they're being oppressed. That makes it a lot harder, I think, for a manager to sort of just tell them to just fucking do the fact checking when it becomes a matter. I mean, does that make sense to you, Katie, as a diagnosis?
Yeah. And then there's, you know, Jonathan Haidt would probably call this an element of safetyism, although I think a lot of safetyism is really performative. And even if people don't actually feel harmed, harm might be the allegation that they go to because it's more likely to have some power. And, you know, our generation was the first to sort of grow up during social media. And I think social media has changed human interaction in these incredibly fundamental ways. And it's probably terrible for all of us. I mean, good for Jesse and I, but you know, terrible for the world on net. And so growing up with that and being hyper online and having more of your interactions mediated through a computer than through face-to-face contact, it changes people. And I don't think necessarily for the better.
Yeah. Katie, did you grow up working class or did you grow up?
Sort of in the middle. My parents were both college professors, but they were college professors at a small state school, like the C-minus school that you go to when you can't get into the other schools. So in the community that I lived in, the community I lived in was very working class, and either your parents taught at the university or they didn't. And because my parents did, I always felt that we were wealthy. We were not, but I think I sort of grew up with this sense of having more privilege than other people around me because my parents were PhDs.
Yeah, sure. So do you guys think and I guess this is going to something Jesse said, it's less generational and it's more kind of individual. Like some people, I'm struggling for words here, but some people take feedback in a constructive way and other people are just very fragile about not.
What do you mean by that, Nick? What the fuck?
Yeah. No, thank you for illustrating that so well. But, and maybe we're making a mistake by thinking about this as a kind of new man or new woman that is the social type of our age. And that it's really just a couple of, it's a fairly small number of people who just happen to kind of control the means of media representation.
I think I'm sympathetic to a version of that because Katie and I have both encountered people, especially on social media, who seem at best difficult and at worst like genuinely disturbed. And when they freak out, they don't get people saying like, you should maybe get that looked into. They get an endless waves of validation for perceiving oneself as a victim and sort of projecting your victimhood and fragility out into the world. Like the way social media just switches these incentives around is very strange and striking to watch. So I think a certain kind of personality gets sort of snared by that maybe.
Yeah, and gets rewarded for it.
Do you think that there's also, one of the things that I've always been, I'm both interested in and I'm genuinely very positively inclined towards this. Over the course of my lifetime, there's just been a proliferation of standards of, the mainstream has died. There was a period in the 90s where alternative on the Billboard charts, alternative was the biggest selling type of music, the official classification. And when you have more value standards out there and more, a kind of more individualized, more personalized ethos in everything, that includes things like journalism standards and whatnot. For the same reason that we have, three dozen types of Pop-Tarts, we also have, three different types of journalistic standards or personality types, et cetera. Maybe this is not such a bad thing.
Jesse, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I guess since I have the lower standards, I should. I think I don't want to be a nuance monger, but I think it's complicated because it's good that that certain versions of the view from nowhere style of journalism died. I think we need it sometimes, but obviously WMDs in Iraq is a good example of that model failing. What worries me is you can't just say there's objective journalism and then ideological journalism because there's ideologies in everything, not to sound like one of those dastardly college Marxists, but it's true. But there's this way ideology is creeping into even mainstream coverage in places like The Times. And it's a very specific sort of ideology that's really just geared at the wokest 15% of the country. And I think that's bringing with it a diminution of standards. But I also think, again, the whole field is in economic freefall, which means less resources for editors and fact checkers and all that. So it's a complicated mix, but I think there's complicated stuff going on with regard to that question of standards.
I am a big, when it comes to most social changes, I'm what used to be called a vulgar Marxist. I believe that the economic base creates a kind of cultural and political superstructure. And Jesse, when you talk about the hollowing out of media, I mean, the model that was in place from probably the 1920s and certainly from the 1950s through a good chunk of the 90s is gone. I mean, like that local newspaper or the local monopoly newspaper that has advertising that floats everybody's boat from big department stores and car dealerships and stuff. Yeah, that's totally gone. And just Jack Schaefer and a couple of people at Politico have just documented the decline in the number of people in traditional newsrooms. And more people are probably employed as writers and as kind of some type of journalist or editor than ever, but in very different circumstances. And I think we don't acknowledge that, or we don't know how to acknowledge that, but it's definitely firing up a lot of this conversation.
And I feel I'm talking too much. I'll let Katie take the next two questions, but I randomly got an email from a Czech journalist who wanted to talk about American journalism and cancel culture, and just talking it through with him. It used to be you could at age 23 go to the Nashua whatever or the Columbus whatever and cover the courts or cover city council and make a living, a middle-class living, gaining expertise covering a beat. That model has been completely eviscerated. Nobody does that anymore. And that's a huge loss to just the concept of journalism. And it's being replaced with people who otherwise would have done that, who are being trained how to churn out hot takes on dumb garbage.
Yeah, I think people get it.
Hot takes on dumb garbage.
That should be our tagline.
That's a very
good
podcast.
That's going on the t-shirts. Yeah, I think people often get it backwards. You'll see this criticism on Twitter, something like go woke, go broke, when you see, you know, online outlets collapsing. And I think they get it exactly backwards. The turn towards hot takes on cool garbage or whatever is a response to the economics, is a response to the internet, it's a response to Craigslist, it's a response to Facebook and just this hollowing out of the industry. And so you also don't see the training grounds that you did, as Jesse mentioned. There are real consequences to that. Like, who is covering the school board, you know? And in some ways, this is good for people like me who are untrained as journalists and prefer to pontificate than actually go to school board meetings. But for the culture, for towns and cities around America, it really has not been good.
So let's talk about, and by the way, as somebody who has covered school board meetings, they are both endlessly important and endlessly dull. And I was working for a couple of now out of business newspapers in central New Jersey back in the day, covering zoning board and planning board meetings. That helped make me into a libertarian, because when you see the details that people have to follow and the absolute kind of martinets who would run these things and just humiliate people for not knowing, you know, how far back from the curb a fence has to be and stuff, it was really crazy making. You guys, though, now are on Patreon. And as I said at the beginning of this, you're pulling in, according to Patreon, and I'm sure they're lying because everybody lies online, but you're pulling in $8,073 per month, which I checked out on my calculator on my phone. It's about 96 grand a year. What's going on with new media? Like, how are you guys going to spend all of that? And, you know, is this, what is good about being able to fund things through something like Patreon for you?
This has been
Jesse has said that, yeah, you get to talk for the next.
And I get the bulk of the earnings too. Thank you, Jesse. This has been just a totally remarkable, sort of shocking experience to see the Patreon grow this quickly. It's great. I mean, before this, until the pandemic started, I was a staffer at an alt weekly. And even though it was an alt weekly, I was...
Oh, and wait, let's stop for a second. The Seattle, I mean, you were a very widely read writer at the Seattle Stranger, which was one of the, you know, the great regional alt weeklies of all time. So, yeah, no, and I mean, this is, it's fascinating when you think about the rise and fall of the alt weekly, you know, arguably beginning with the Village Voice in New York in the mid 50s. I mean, it's all over now, right? But yeah, what was it like to be at the Stranger at a, you know, as it was kind of going? I mean, it's still around. Kind of, but in receivership.
It was difficult. It was so the great thing about The Stranger, I'd been reading The Stranger and The Stranger's sister paper, The Portland Mercury, for 15 years. And when I started reading them, both were funny. They were filled with sharp, biting satire. And you oftentimes couldn't tell what was a genuine, you know, piece and what was just absolute, just like utter parody. And I loved it for that. And by the time I got there, things had really changed. I mean, part of it just the staff was much, much smaller. You know, instead of having a weekly deadline, you had multiple deadlines a day. So at the same time that there was fewer people to do the work, there was more work to do. And, you know, that had lots of impacts on sort of the kind of just the vibe of the paper. But not only that, the culture had changed as well. And so things like satire, we basically couldn't do satire anymore. And part of that was because after the rise of, you know, quote unquote, fake news, people were scared that we would put things online that people would genuinely think were real, and they wouldn't be, you know, people. And that wouldn't have been a concern 15 years ago. 15 years ago, that would have been good. You know, you don't, you fucking dumb shits.
Yeah, no, that was that's what you were hoping to be taken seriously.
Right. So the paper, there's still some funny writers there, but the paper really lost that sort of biting edge. And I was in sort of a socially an awkward position because most people there, sort of this, the division was primarily age-related, but the younger people thought that I was a, you know, literal Nazi. And that was, it's awkward to be in a position where you know that your coworkers don't like you. So it had been my, I
thankfully have avoided that by basically working from home for the past 25
years. Well, I still know
what
it's like because I work with Jesse now and we hate each other. So it's a...
She's a Nazi. Yeah,
literal Nazi. nothing has changed. So it was a difficult place to work. And that was sort of disheartening because The Stranger was my dream job. You know, there was two places I ever wanted to work and The Stranger was one of them. And the first was National Public Radio.
Der Sturmer was the other one, I guess.
That was actually number one. The Stranger was number two. So it was just, it was awkward. It wasn't the sort of the alt weekly that I wanted it to be from 15 years ago. And a lot of that is just things change, you know, things just fucking change.
So now you are liberated though, right?
I am free.
You've been kicked off the plantation and now you are able to go to Patreon where you can set your own wages and all of that.
I have been liberated from Chaz. Patreon is great. I mean, you know, it's totally possible that tomorrow we'll say something that pisses off our patrons and we will lose our support and like the show will be over. But we'd have to lose a lot of them at once to do it. And so having that sort of distributed funding where it's a lot of little, we're the Bernie Sanders model of funding. I feel more free to speak my mind now than I did writing at The Stranger for 3 years. I don't have to worry. One of the things that sort of made it difficult to be totally honest at the paper was because if I really spoke the truth, and I tried to as much as possible, but I always had to be concerned about the letters that my editor were going to get. And not because I thought my editors were going to fire me. I didn't think so. I did have institutional support from sort of the higher ups at the paper, if not my direct colleagues. But you're causing them a headache. You know, you're putting stress on people. And that's just, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that to people you like. And I don't have to worry about that now. You know, the only asshole I have to worry about is Jesse Single. And if people want to send him emails about how I'm a terrible person, well, he can deal with it.
You know, Ed, you remind me, not only were alt weeklies at a certain point, this real kind of great firecracker that often typically you would get for free, you know, but it would include a lot of different voices. Salon, one of the early publications, pure zine, you know, online magazines of the early internet, was like that, where they had Camille Paglia and David Horowitz, you know, among other people in every pay, or, you know, in every week or something like that. And it was just, that was a selling point. The idea that you would have this crazy mix of different voices who would be duking it out with each other. And that certainly that model of journalism seems to have faded. Jesse, you were at New York Magazine for a while, which is also has a remarkable, you know, kind of history. It was one of the real show horses. I mean, it came out of the old New York Herald Tribune, their Sunday magazine. And it was one of the show places for what was called the New Journalism back in the day, people like Tom Wolfe. What was your experience there? And now it's in a joint operating agreement or it's owned by Vox, right? Is that good or bad for New York?
So I'm still a contributing writer there, which is, you know, I write for them somewhat. My time there was amazing. I arrived in 2014 to edit a section about behavioral science, which is sort of one of my main areas and what I'm working on.
What was that? Did you have a stupid, cute, clever name for that?
Science of Us, which I thought was fine.
Okay. No, that's not bad.
There's been worse names.
I thought it was going to be like single-minded or, you know,
I would never do something that dumb. Yeah. Single-minded.
Point taken, that type of thing.
Definitely check out jessesingle.substack.com, my newsletter, single-minded. I'm an entrepreneur now. I just got to drop these little nuggets. New York Magazine was great. About halfway through my time there, I was there about 3 years, I switched from an editing role with some writing to just an all-writing role. And they let me write about everything, like a little bit of politics, a lot of like internet bullshit, a lot of behavioral science still. It was pretty close to a dream job. And the sort of cultural forces hitting journalism now that may or may not be hitting New York Magazine as well, I didn't encounter those even when I wrote controversial stuff, and I left in 2017 to focus on my book. So I would like to continue writing for New York Magazine. I guess some of my skepticism is just like having Vox, having a massive media, I don't know if you call it an empire because they have financial issues too. I think I am a little bit worried that it might be a-
trust me, empires, this is the libertarian in me saying, but empires typically have massive financial problems.
Right. So well, exactly. Yeah.
That comes with the territory.
I'm not, you know what? I'm not going to get in trouble for saying this. I'm a little bit worried. I think Vox provided them some stability financially. I think Vox ranges from doing amazing stuff on policy to very predictable stuff on culture. And I think New York Magazine has always been so good and have such a distinctive voice on the cultural stuff that I mostly don't know anything about. I just hope they're able to retain that.
Yeah, and New York Magazine as a website, particularly for its type of, kind of glossy magazine that would always win a basket full of national magazine awards and things like that, had probably the best transition to the web of any of like the kind of major publications. Some of them caught up eventually, others like Harper's just kind of faded away. Sadly, but New York has, they've kept it together. I mean, always, it's one of the few magazines that I actually pay to read online. So
they're excellent,
especially knowing that you're not on there anymore. So, Jesse, what do you like about Patreon? And I guess let me throw this out to both of you as a kind of final question. Do you worry at all that you, without an editor, and I mean, you have the constraints of an audience, but it's kind of like you guys are like Colonel Kurtz now, right? You've kicked free of anybody telling you, don't do that, don't do that. I think a lot of, I dislike the old studio system in movies or the label system in music. But God damn it, if the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is not littered with people who got so big that the label could no longer tell them, you know what, that really fucking sucks. Would you try it again? Like, do you worry about that at all? You have terrible, terrible freedom here. Is that going to be the end of it?
The thought has never crossed my mind, but now I'm going to worry about it. I do think our editor, our listeners can provide a sort of check on any sort of insane ideas that we have. And we can provide that check for each other.
And we say this as Jesse is not able to work, or he won't show on video on Zoom. And he's probably wearing tissue boxes as slippers right now.
He's definitely not wearing a shirt. Okay. I think we can check each other in a way that's helpful, or at least I can check Jesse. He has no reason to check me.
Katie, every episode, she has this whole theory. I happen to be Jewish. She has this whole theory about sort of the bone structure of Jewish people versus other races being different, and she keeps wanting to do a long segment on it. I keep telling her, in the current climate, maybe not the best idea.
Yeah, I would keep that behind the paywall at Patreon. I don't know.
That's for the top tier.
There's a super
$100 race science tier.
The Elders of Zion.
You just have a bumpy skull, Jesse. That's all it is.
I know. That's what I'm telling you. It has nothing to do with being Jewish. It's just a weird
You were laid too much on your back as a baby.
To get us out of this descent into madness. Can one of you say, what do you hope to accomplish with the podcast?
God, Jesse,
we've gotten a lot of a rush of weirdly earnest emails from people who said they thought they were losing their mind looking around. If we can give people a place to not lose their mind and reduce the risk that they will wander off in like a right wing or far right wing direction, which I think the right has been good at peeling off people who are sick of the cultural bullshit. I'd like to do that. And also, frankly, we would like this to grow financially as much as possible, because it'd be amazing to make a living podcasting, which we're pretty close to being able to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is, phenomenal.
I've already started planning the above ground pool. I'm going to build in my backyard. So that's my goal.
I'm going to start treating.
Wow, you are dreaming big, the above ground.
I'm from Appalachia.
Pool.
What can I say?
Yeah, we used to call them cement ponds. Yeah. That is like something else. Well, we're going to leave it there. I have been talking with Katie Herzog and Jesse Singel of the podcast Blocked and Reported. Check them out at Patreon or Google it and listen to them everywhere. Guys, thanks very much. Your stories are, your personal stories are fascinating to me. And also, your product, the podcast, is really great. So I wish you much success with that. And I appreciate the fact that you guys are keeping a set of conversations going that otherwise
thanks,
wouldn't
Nick.
Be.
Thank you so much for that. Yeah, appreciate it.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or at reason.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.